copy. I went to tweet and fucking between the iPhone. I know it's one of those halachas that it depends on the generation what the minhag is, but also it could be a question of the minhag or isha or like that. Is there any time to say that a male can tweet his eyebrows?
It's embarrassing, by the way he looks. It does not look like most men look.
Kidding, I feel that I've been doing it for many years, and if not, it would be one brow. That would bother me very much. What is that called?
No, basically, number one, they're a hetzerim for a bucha. They're not fucking with the adult in a unibrow, which many people are aware of.
Yeah.
So you're allowed to fuck. Okay.
It's good tiring, but you stay up till 3 in the morning and then the boys sleep in and you have to get up for chapters. So it's very good. It's nice to be home. Nothing like that. I really hope that I've got it.
He's either leave, so you get the hana of coming back.
By the way, I wanted to thank you. They asked me off the cuff while I was there to give the introduction. I was teaching you tomorrow. Someone else was supposed to give the introduction to tomorrow's shiur for an hour. And so they asked me 5 minutes before, like, will you give the introduction to tomorrow's shiur? The guy didn't turn up, whatever it is. So I just parroted what I heard from you in Lakewood. I wanted to thank you, sir. And apologize for saying your Torah in my name.
But you know, that's your Torah in my name.
I felt pretty good with the making cake and
She said, dude, man, those waves are gnarly.
There's no way someone actually already said that. I mean, we're in California.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, everyone hear that?
Yeah.
Anthony Robinson.
One more thought just before.
Brandon, is Rebbe speaking for us now?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, perfect. Just one more thought. Gentlemen.
No, it's better this way. One last thought, gentlemen.
Is
we asked it. I asked it. I was thinking about this. We asked it.
Oh, that's
because it takes you to fail, right? How many people don't start a goal? They don't start doing something that they know things will work to make them out of a better place. And they don't do it. Why? Because they think, well, that's me up here, and I'm right here, and I'll never be able to get there. Right? That's another reason why people don't go after high-level goal achievement. Oh, but what does the Torah teach us, Jonathan? What does the Torah teach us?
When you get
your next world gentleman, you are judged on the effort you put in. You get the Torah, where it's different from anything else, is in this world, the way businesses work, the way going up the corporate ladder works, is that you have to do a lot, and maybe you'll get better. As long as you're trying, as long as you're in the process of trying to be better,
The retreat place that we were staying at had a rule that you could only have organic food. And when we go in, the woman like gave us a feast, and so we showed that we had organic food in, and she had not. She way of talking about it. Every time she said organic, she was like this.
Right.
We only eat organic. One time, she has a kosher wine. A great tenant makes a chianic version. This bottle of wine is organic, comprehensive, and biodiversity.
Shalom Aleichem.
Shalom, how are you? Everybody, good to see you.
Hi everybody.
I'm not the official greeter, but I do want to welcome you all to Yerushalayim and to Or Sameach, and all of us hope that you will love your stay in Israel, which after all is the home of the Jewish people. And this is a way that you'll connect or reconnect or strengthen your connection to God and the Torah and Am Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael. And of course, we also welcome our collaborators and our partners in the educational program, our mentors, mainly from the United States. who will be teaching you and learning with you and developing a personal relationship with you. And all of us hope that the relationship you will develop with your individual mentors will carry over, because after all, you do come from the same country, that when you get back to America, keep that connection, because this is really, after all, only a beginning. We hope eventually you'll come to Israel, maybe live in Israel. I myself, my wife and I, made Aliyah just 6 years ago, so I'm still a newcomer, still finding my way around. You know, Eretz Yisrael is a good place, land of the Jews, but whatever it is, we hope that wherever you wind up living, whatever you wind up doing, you will be connected to the land and to the Torah and to God and to the Jewish people. And in many, many ways, the very fact that you came here during a time of the year where you could have been doing many, many things, including going to Florida or whatever it is really a tribute to the fact that you do want to be connected. And I want to give you, as we say, Yashar Koach, kind of a congratulations for making this great, great, great decision. So we're going to start a regular learning session very soon. I'm sorry, is there a Shiva one that you want to say?
No.
Okay. We're going to start our regular learning session very, very soon, so I'm just here to give you a bit of warm-up, a little bit of introduction, and I'm going to do two things at once, or at least two things within a very small amount of time, so obviously I will not cover either thing very thoroughly, but just to kind of pave the way. You know, the main thing that we will be learning intensively over the next few days is Talmud, or Gemara. And it's interesting that when people first learn Gemara, and I don't know, for some of you this may be the very first time, the Talmud, and for some of you, you may have done this already, but sometimes people are a little confused exactly what is the Gemara, because on one hand, one would expect that the Gemara is the interpretation. We have the written Torah, which is the five books of Moses, that we believe that God dictated to Moses, and Moses wrote it down word for word for word for word. But the five books of Moses, there are many passages that one cannot really understand. That there was a supplementary oral tradition that explained it. So, for example, don't do work on Shabbos. On Shabbat, don't do work on Shabbos. That's what the Torah says. Well, that's fine, but what's doing work? Is going to a movie work? Is turning on my iPad work? Whatever it is. And as a result, these are not self-explanatory terms. You should put something around your head and on your hands. Now we know that means the black boxes of the tefillin with the straps, but if you just read the written text, you'd have no idea what that is. Even the English is not going to help you. Put on phylacteries. What on earth are phylacteries? Well, phylacteries are tefillin. Okay, what are tefillin? You know, I mean, the word tefillin doesn't appear in the biblical text anyway. So, consequently, it's an axiomatic principle of the Jewish faith that side by side with a written text that God directly communicated to Moses to be written down, and that is the Torah scroll, there was a supplementary interpretation of the Torah that was given orally to be handed down from generation to generation. And this is just as authoritative as the written text itself. There is the written Torah. There is the oral Torah, Torah Shebal Peh, Torah Shebichtav. And sometimes the oral Torah actually changes what you might have thought the written meaning of the text is. For example, the Torah says in the book of Exodus, the very famous statement, the Lex Talionis, that if I knock somebody's eye out, right, the famous verse, the Mickey Spillane novel, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And yet we know that the oral law tells us that is not what the written text is supposed to mean. The written text actually means compensation. If I damage your eye, we somehow assess, it's hard to figure out how you do that, what is the value of an eye? And it's based on a hypothetical slave market, meaning how much would you be worth with two eyes, and how much are you worth with one eye, and that represents, economically at least, the difference of an eye. But that's a major reinterpretation, but you have to understand that the foundation of the Jewish faith is, this was not like you would say secularly, oh, there was this old law that was primitive and barbaric, and we changed it. That's not the way we understand it. Rather, we understand that side by side with the written text God told Moses that this is how it is to be understood. Now, here is the thing. You have to understand that the concept of the oral law is multifaceted. It is not a single thing, meaning a lot of it God gave to Moses, but a lot of it involves interpretation, how to apply the principles to new situations. For example, I mean, I'll use modern examples, because although the Talmud is replete with these examples, let's take a modern example, electricity. Right? Electricity was, I'm not saying invented, electricity was not invented, it exists in nature, but let's say electricity was harnessed in the 19th century. Now, as soon as electricity gets harnessed, gets utilized, there's an immediate question. Am I allowed to turn on electric lights on the Shabbos? Now, the Torah doesn't say, thou shalt not use electricity. You're not going to find a verse that says that. But what do you see in the Torah? Do not make fire on Shabbos. Do not burn fire. And the Talmud discusses different types of fire and the like. None of it involves electricity directly. But immediately, there has to be a discussion. Well, does electricity meet the definition of fire or not? As you know, the consensus of halacha is that it does, but this had to be debated. This had to be discussed. Now, you have to understand that when we have to face a new issue, whether it be electricity, or whether it be in the modern age surrogate motherhood, or whether it be cloning, or whether it be nuclear war, or whatever it might be, and we have to ask ourselves, what does Jewish law say about these matters? So what do? We look at the written Torah, and we look at the Talmud, which is the repository of the oral Torah, and we try to figure out precedents, and we try to figure out analogies, and different people will come to a different conclusion. And some will say, oh, this is analogous to X. And some will say, no, this is analogous to Y. And there'll be different opinions. You have to understand that you're not dealing with the issue of what did God say. Because God did not directly address surrogate motherhood. God gave principles out of which the later sages, including up to this day, have to debate and extrapolate. And that is why the Talmud says, paradoxically, that even mutually exclusive opinions, one says kosher, one says treif, if they're working within the methodology and the principles of the oral law, God legitimates both views, assuming that you're working within the principles and you're authorized. Now, if you think about this, this is a very funny way to deliver a legal system. If God wants to give us a Torah, wants to give us a law, wants to give us a way of living our lives, why does he only do half of the job? He kind of gives us the principles and then says, work out their implications. That creates ambiguity, that creates uncertainty, that creates divisiveness, that creates different views, right? The famous expression, two Jews, three opinions, actually is probably based on the nature of Talmudic study, in which you will see that over and over and over again. Why didn't God just give Moses the rules for everything? Now, you might say, well, that wouldn't have worked because 3,500 years ago, they wouldn't have known what surrogate motherhood is or cloning or electricity. So by definition, God couldn't give the rules then. Well, God could do a lot of things. God could give Moses a bunch of envelopes and say, don't open this envelope before I won't use the second year, but before 5600. Now we're in 5776. In other words, God seemed, as it were, to bifurcate the definite principles that he gave in the written and the oral law, and then leave their development to the later generations, in which there could be machloket. Machloket means argument. See, I'm actually trying to answer a question which I didn't articulate. The question that people often ask is that one of the first things you're going to encounter in Talmudic study is arguments. And people scratch their head and they say, well, wait a second. If everything comes from God, then how could there be an argument? God either said, said yes, or God said no. God said kosher, God said treif. God said permitted, God said forbidden. If there's an argument, then somebody got it wrong. The answer is that's not true. Because if you understand revelation as a process that was concerned with fundamental principles, and then based on those principles, it was left to the later generations to extrapolate and apply those principles, then as the Rambam, as Maimonides writes in the introduction to the Mishnah, it is entirely possible that two people are working with the same sets of principles and they infer different conclusions, and one cannot automatically condemn one as wrong versus the other, as long as they're operating with the same principles and the logic of their positions is sound. It is not like a mathematical truth in which 2 plus 2 is 4, and if you say it's 5, you're wrong. Rather, this is a type of process that can admit of multiplicity of conclusion. But the question still becomes, why did God give it that way? That's a very messy process. And there's actually a very, very deep meaning to this. And this is a mashal, this is a parable I've used many times, so forgive me if some of you have heard it. And this is, let's imagine you want to make a cake for your child, right? Your child is 4 years old, and you want to make them a cake for their birthday. Now, there are two ways you can make the cake. The best way to make the cake is when the kid is sleeping or in nursery or kindergarten, you just make the cake. I don't know how skillful you are in baking, but if you know how to make a cake, you know, it would take, you know, 15, 20 minutes and then put it in the oven for a while, and it'll be perfect, it'll be fine. And when the kid comes home or wakes up, you give them a cake. But there's another way of making the cake, which is deeper and more meaningful. That is, you make the cake with the four-year-old. You involve them in the process. You do something together with them. That shows love. That shows relationship. Now, the cake that you're going to make with a four-year-old is going to be a very messy cake. It'll be lumpy. There may be sugar on the kitchen floor. There may be chocolate powder, whatever it is, on the table. Eggshells. Part of it may be burnt. Part of it may be underbaked. You could do a much better job without the four-year-old's input. But the meaningfulness and preciousness of the cake lies not in the quality of the cake, but it lies in the depth of the relationship and love. God could have given us a Torah with every single answer explicitly in the text of the Torah itself. Every answer. But God says, I want you, the Jewish people, through their sages and scholars, to be co-creators of the Torah. I'm going to give you the raw material. I'm going to give you the principles. I'm going to give you the basic foundations. And then I want you to make the cake with me in terms of applying the eternal truths of the Torah to the ever-changing realities of everyday life. Torah is eternal and unchanging, to be sure. But life is ever-changing. And how you apply the eternal truths to the ever-changing vicissitudes of human existence, whether it be technology or any other area, that is where God says, we need you to be a partner. And thus, when you read the Gemara, now again, I'm not giving you all history here, meaning a lot of this was oral. Eventually it got written down because there was a danger of things getting forgotten. But the Gemara, the Talmud, is not a book of law. It doesn't give you cut and dried propositions. It brings you into the laboratory, as it were, in which there will be ideas, there'll be a hypothesis, there'll be a refutation, there'll be alternative constructions, there'll be arguments, there'll be different ways of looking over things. And you become part of that process. You know, when we learn Gemara and we say, Rabbi so-and-so says, please note that we use the present tense. We don't say, Hillel said. Hillel says. Because they're all alive. You have the rabbis of Babylonia and Eretz Yisrael, and then the commentaries from France and from Germany and from Russia, and then guys from America coming in, discussing. You're part of this process. The Talmud is the attempt not simply to be given the truth, but to discover the truth by analysis, by reasoning, by debate. But that's not a contradiction to revelation, because revelation itself never predetermined a fixed rule for every situation. It gave divine principles out of which we grapple to apply these. And that is why the Talmud very much is concerned not so much with final rulings, although we have other books that give us final rulings. The Talmud is concerned with the process. And in that process, you become connected to God because you are, as it were, going through God's thinking. You're going through God's mind, and you're connecting to God in that particular way. So if Talmud is confusing, so be it. I mean, I will tell you this. One of the most confusing areas of American law is the tax code, the Internal Revenue Code. So I will tell you, when American judges like to describe how complicated the Internal Revenue Code is, this is a common phrase, and it says, it is almost of Talmudic reasoning. That's how the Internal Revenue Code is described, right? So even the Goyim, even the non-Jews, recognize that the Talmud is very, very complex. But you understand, it is not about bottom line, at least that stage that we're studying it. It's about process. And therefore, as a result, you are a participant in that process. You bring your reasoning and your creativity and your understandings. You do so with great humility and great modesty, because the scholars in the Talmud and the commentaries are far greater than we are. But if things bother you, you bring up those questions. Sometimes there will be answers to the questions, sometimes there will not be answers that we will know at any given moment. But the whole point is to discuss, to debate. This is why Jews... Why are Jews such good debaters? At least they used to... maybe it's less so today because sometimes so many Jews are disattached from the tradition. But all of these things, the whole idea of Jews being debaters and Jews being arguers, this really comes from the centuries and centuries of immersion in this type of study. It trains the mind, but it also spiritualizes the passions by connecting yourself to God. So the particular topic that we're looking at is a topic that's actually a very, very important topic. And again, it represents the notion of dialectic and contradiction that is so much prevalent in all aspects. Right? To be a Jew, Rosh Hashiva often says, to be a Jew means to live with contradictions. And this is a mini example of that. We talk about the value of truth. God is a God of truth. God hates lies. God hates falsity. There are verses in the Psalms, first of all, in the Torah itself, it says, Midvar Sheker Tirchak, you shall distance yourself from lying. If one lies, they are violating one of the 613 commandments of the Torah. In the book of Psalms, we read that those who speak falsehood shall not stand in the presence of God in the world to come and the like. So lying is a very, very serious thing. Jews have to be people of, actually all human beings, but Jews in particular, have to be people of truth. Okay, that's principle number one. Principle number two is, sometimes you're supposed to lie. Right? To take an extreme example, some terrorist with a machine gun comes down the street and asks you, where are those kids going to school? Can you direct me to the fifth grade? Well, obviously, you don't give them that information, or you send them, it's near that police station over there, whatever it would be. Now, that's an obvious simple case. That's not even discussed in the Talmud because that's so obvious. But it does bring to mind that, it's one thing to say, thou shalt not lie, but there are going to be times in which maybe not only is it permitted to lie, but it's necessary to lie. Rule and exception. How do we understand that? How do we balance it? When do I say there are considerations greater than the truth that would justify sheker? Right? That is the type of problem the Talmud is always grappling with. It's very simple to live your life in a purely binary way. Everything is yes or everything is no. But life is more complicated. And the divine law of God, who after all is the author of life as well, has to take account of those nuances and shades of gray and create the appropriate balance and the light. That's going to be one set of issues that you're going to be looking at. And there are, in addition to the material, you'll notice there are also in your booklet there are questions, actual hypotheticals that you can look at, and you can give yourself a test, so to speak, as to how would you apply the Talmudic passages to more contemporary situations. Let me point out as well that another issue that we have to deal with is, well, is an omission of the truth the same as lying? What if I don't lie, but I simply don't tell you something that I don't want you to know? So, for example, I'm selling you a car, and the car has a transmission problem. Now, if I tell you the transmission is fine, that's called a lie. What if I didn't say anything because you were not smart enough to ask me a direct question? Is that a lie? Is that a lesser offense? Is omission not as bad as commission? Is it the same? So you're going to see that there's a concept in law, not only in halacha, not only called sheker, which is lying, but a very interesting phrase called genevas das. Genevas das literally means stealing of the mind, meaning I've generated a misimpression in you by not doing something, even though I didn't affirmatively mislead. Now, we know in secular law for many, many years, although the legal system changed, there was a principle called caveat emptor, which means let the buyer beware again, and that's changed a lot in secular law as well. But that kind of means, if I'm selling you a house that happens to be termite infested that's going to fall apart in next week, as long as you didn't ask, I didn't have to tell you. That's called caveat emptor in Latin, the buyer beware. Again, the law's changed. I'm not giving you a class on the secular law today. Well, does halacha recognize that? Or does halacha say that not only can't I lie, but I got to give you all the information you need to make that decision, right? You're going to look at that. What about social events, right? You'll see the Talmud has a story where two people were walking in the street and they met a person who was coming to visit them. And the person said, I'm so honored that you left your house to greet me personally. And you didn't leave the house to greet him personally. You had to get a paper or something. Well, are you supposed to say, oh no, sorry, we didn't really go out for you? Well, maybe it's better not to correct the impression if it's going to hurt the person's feelings. Right? Does that have a role here? Is there a difference in lying and not? Somebody, you know, your wife asks you, how do you like my hat or my dress? And you can't stand it? What do you say? Right? Domestically, there are going to be these issues as well. Right? So those are the kind of things we're going to be studying. Now, I'll just end here because I don't want to take up all of the time. And that is, you know, Aristotle already pointed out that there are two types of reasoning, two types of logical reasoning. There is what is called deductive reasoning, and there is what is called inductive reasoning. Deductive reasoning is when you start off with a general principle, and then when you have specific cases, you ask yourself, how would these cases be governed by this principle? Inductive reasoning is when you start with a lot of cases and a lot of observations, you then try to formulate, right, from the particulars, you try to come to a generalization. Talmudic reasoning is a combination of the inductive and the deductive, meaning we start with a lot of specific cases and specific rulings. In this case, the law was this, and in this case, the law was this, and in this case, the law was this. You then look at those points and you try to formulate a generalization that would explain them. That is the inductive part of the reasoning. Then, as new cases come to light, contemporary issues, you then apply the general principle to those new cases, right? So that is a deductive, right? So you start with induction, you formulate a generalization, and then you deductively apply it to new situations. But then you'll understand that you always have to recheck your premises, because maybe your induction was incorrect, because maybe your theory might explain 10 out of 12 cases, but not all 12 of them, so you have to reformulate, etc. So there's this constant process of reformulating the generalizations, and then applying those generalizations to new situations. Okay, so this is the type of thing that you will be doing. Again, if initially you're confused, you know, so be it. I mean, it doesn't have to be initially. I mean, many of us have been learning Talmud for many, many years, and we're still often confused. That is the nature of it. But as our sages have tell us, the very process of grappling and struggling with God's Torah is a tremendously rewarding process. So may Hashem give you much blessing in your journey, and may be this be the beginning of a journey that you will take all of your lives.
Good. Amen.
Thank you so much, Rebbe. Thank you for putting together the sugya. We're going to go now to the main base medrash, down the walkway. Sure, will your mentor, the students are, please, yourself or Rabbi Katz or any other staff members. The learning booklets are in the base medrash in the back. It's right when you see it.
Baruch Hashem.
because, you know, I did mentor stuff, and I just looked at different things. No, it's fine. I just have to talk to the mentors. Then I have to get my share, then I have to go to the center. Yeah. Okay. I'll find that. I mean, they're not going to the coastal, so everything's going to be there earlier. Maybe. And then the Coleman thing is just exploding. Why do these kids want to get married so quickly? It's the same problem, you know, they have this thing, they have to get married. I mean, Yisrael man was not ready for marriage. He just wasn't ready to get married. I mean, he shouldn't have gotten married. I know, but he just wasn't ready to get married. He just wasn't ready. But this problem is over and over again. Like the plastic, over and over again. These guys get into their head, they have to get married. They're not ready. I didn't see him yet. I told him he has to meet with me. I never do this, but I always say, if you want to meet, I said no. I said you should come to my office. I said he has to meet with me. She called me a moment. Whatever he keeps on saying, I hear it from her perspective. He's not saying hurtful things to her. You know, we shouldn't have gotten married. I think he wasn't ready before. He just listen before booking during the engagement. I mean, he is a control freak. He has to have control, and he recognizes that, which is good actually. He recognizes that, you know, he says, you know, she ate too much. And he said, you know. You know, just when she eats on Shabbos, it just gets me so nervous that she's talking to a fat guy. But yeah. I don't remember. It wasn't the last thing. It was more that she's going to gain a pound here and there. Okay, yeah, all right. Okay. I mean, what was the rush in getting married? What were these people not ready to get married? They're just not ready. Too much baggage. She thanked me. Okay, I'll read it to you if you want. One second.
I'll have it in a second. Yeah. Right. is what I wrote to Malka. Much thanks for the videos and the information. It is quite an impressive series. I have heard about the three principles, and they seem to be a remarkable way of getting unstuck, moving beyond the past to attain inner serenity and happiness. You may know that the founder of this school, Sydney Banks, only finished ninth grade and worked as a welder, but had some type of spiritual epiphany that changed his life. A quite amazing start. Had some type of spiritual epiphany that changed his life. A quite amazing story on its own. In any case, I will contact the affected family and ask them to look at this. With much brother. If you want to know what I sent to Brandon, that's what I sent them the link to the video. And they said, "Dear Avram and Sarah, I hope you are well. In speaking with a friend about your predicament without using names or even places, it was suggested that a program called The Three Principles might be helpful in a number of different ways. Number one, it could help Sam in his own identity crisis. Number two, it could help Adina and Shmaryo in maintaining a good, positive, and loving relationship with their only son. And number three, it can help you in keeping the family together. I am somewhat familiar with the program, which indeed has helped many people. More importantly, Rev Michal and the Revitson Tversky utilize this program in their own counseling. It is possible that Rev Tversky could recommend a Three Principles facilitator who may be able to help Sam or his parents. According to my friend," I just quote Malka's email at the end, "I am aware that there's a plethora of therapies out there, so many that it can be hard to have hope in yet another. This approach is a different ball game. The Tversky's in Milwaukee were alerted to it and brought it into the world after they became very disheartened." This is just a quote from them. "With the only modest results they saw in people they had referred to other practitioners." I just quoted it because it wasn't my words. But. All right, so I said that's it. Okay. No. I used no name at all. I just said it was my friend. Whatever. Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. All right then. Okay. Anyway, I love you too, Ben. Oh, really? Okay, that's great. I like it. Okay. It's so funny, you know, Fox News is ultra-conservative. But they have Chris Wallace, who tries to be objective a little bit. So the ultra-conservative, like everything Obama says, they want to turn into racism. Obama was giving a speech about health care to the Black caucus. So he said, "We're going to win this fight." He says, "We've been through darker moments before." So the Fox guy is jumping on it and say, he's interviewing Chris Wallace. He says, isn't this a new high in racism? Isn't this a show, you know, black baiting, race baiting? He says, "We've never had this in the history of the United States, you know, a president who uses race." So Chris Wallace, like, gives him a Miam Loe stare. And the guy says, "What do you think, Chris? Isn't this like the worst example of race baiting?" So Chris Wallace just looks at him. It's amazing, they're on the same network. He looks at him and says, "Do you want me to talk about the health care?" I mean, it's really great. He says, you look so good. And then Chris Weller says, you know, So then Chris Weller says to him, you know, I still love you guys. So the person says, you have a strange way of showing it. I mean, they really do. It's really strange. I mean, to manage the way they like attack each other. Yeah. Okay, let's take you home, Steve. Between a kitana and a chareches, right? A kitana has miyun and a chareches needs a get. And the Gemara explained that the problem would be that if a chareches would have a right of miyun, she would always have that right. And therefore people wouldn't want to marry her because she could walk out at any moment. By a kitana, you know that she's going to lose that right when she becomes a gedola. So that's one difference. Then we had another difference that a kitana can eat truma. But a chareches cannot eat truma, and the Gemara's answer to chareches is that even the Rif didn't speak out the whole Gemara, which is a little strange. But a chareches cannot eat truma, lest you have a pitachas who marries a charesh eating truma, and that would be an issue of the Arisa because she's a bastas. So now we have a third question: Umayishna kitana the yisla kisuba. A kitana has a ksuba. Now the Yemma says this is not exactly what it means. You have to understand that a kitana can be yotzis for miyun. But you can also give a kitana a get. Let's say she doesn't want to leave. I can give her a get if she yodas this for a kitana. Now, if she's yotzis for miyun, she in fact does not get a ksuba. Because it's a natural and a prayer. So when we say Katana gets a ksuba, this means if she didn't want to leave, and I gave her a get, she gets a ksuba. And yet, when I give a chareshes a get, she does not get a ksuba. And we're going to reprove that person, and we're going to ask why is there a difference. Umay shna Katana that if she gets a get, not me, is la ksuba. Umay shna chareshes, the less la ksuba. So here the Gemara also gives the answer, the imkain mimnoi lo nasua, meaning a chareshes is not an attractive, like you say, it's a joke, I'm very precarious, get the wine doesn't talk about it, shouldn't say that, but anyway, but a chareshes, the Gemara holds, is not an attractive candidate for marriage, so therefore paradoxically, Chazal said, if they would impose a ksuba obligation, people wouldn't want to marry him. This way you'll marry. Now then we ask Mukhitana the Iswak Subha Mimama. How do I know that Mukhitana has a Ksuba? It's not, because the Mishnah says a Mimaenas doesn't get a Ksuba. Vice the Chais, if she gets his forget, she'll get a Ksuba. Because it's only Alphamiyam she doesn't get a Ksuba. So it mentions in the Mishnah, a Mimaenas does not get a Ksuba because she's Aiko Mafreya, Shnia. Right, a forbidden Erev Midrabana does not get Ksuba, and an idleness, which is a Mekakai, does not get Ksuba. But the deal is, this is not in the Mishnah itself, that it's only a Mimaenis that doesn't get Ksuba, and will yet to the get, but a Kitana that is given a get, Yeshma Ksuba. Now, that's how I know a Kitana gets a Ksuba. The Chayreshes, the less well Ksuba, now how do I know a Chayreshes does not get Ksuba? That is from a Braisa. The Braisa Taka says, the Sanya, Cheresh v'shaita shenosu nashim kikreis, afal pi shenispakeach ha-cheresh v'nishtaka ha-shaita. Even if they get better, ein lahem alav klum, there is no obligation of ksuba, ratzu v'kaimishim, see, here's an akamina. There is a halacha that you're not allowed to live with a woman without a ksuba. So here's the point. If I marry a chareshes, there's no ksuba initially. But as soon as she gets better, if I want to divorce her right away, I don't have to give her a ksuba. If I want to stay married to her, I do have a ksuba, and the ksuba will be in mana, because the chi of ksuba is not from the time of the marriage. The chi of ksuba is from the time that she became a tikachas, and at that point she's already a ba'ula, ba'ula satsma. And the ba'ula satsma only gets a ksuba of a Avimana. Similarly, Pikeya Shinasa Chareshen, so Shaita, Apa Pishakasav Lam Neyamana. In other words, if you made a Ksuba, if you made a Ksuba, then Ksubasa Kayeves, no matter how expensive it is, the Bnei Shehu Reitze, Lisa Pinachasav, if he wants to throw away his money, he can do it, but it's only because Kaima Deratza, only because he wrote a Ksuba. Holo Ratzalai, and the reason is, DMK, Minoi Bolo Nasfila. In other words, as the Gemara says, if we tell the man, you gotta give her a ksuba, the Pikeach would not want to marry the Chareshes. So, Frek the Gemara, if that's so, Iyavi. In other words, a Pikeach would not marry a Chareshes if he'd have to pay a ksuba. That's the Cheshire. So, Frek the Gemara, Eva Zoi, Pikachas Lecheresh. Now, there too, she doesn't get a ksuba. Why don't you say the same svara? A Pikachas will not agree to marry a Cheresh unless she gets a ksuba. So, let's be misakin, a ksuba for a Pikachas, DMK, Mimna Velo Naspile. She would not marry him. The answer is no. A woman is more desperate, so to speak, and therefore, if she can't find a suitable husband, she will marry the cheresh even without a ksuba. And that's based on the principle, Yoser Mima Sheish writes Elisa, Isha writes Lihinos. Okay. So now the Rift has a din, which is not in the Gemara. So it turns out that there's no ksuba, by cheresh, there's no ksuba either way. Cheresh to chereshes, cheresh to pikachas, and pikeach to a chereshes. There is no ksuba between
them. And the other thing is written at all? Does she get anything? Or is
well, she gets nothing at all except the property she brought in, and that would be it. But now the Rif adds the following. The Rif adds a very important qualification. Hai yamrina pikachas to cheresh, less lo ksuba. Hani Mili, the Insibul Ameyatma, if she simply gets married to the guy in front of Adam, so she's not entitled to a ksuba. Avo, I Ansobua Lei Beidina. So apparently there was a provision that the Beis Din, meaning the Jewish community, would find Shiduchim for Chershi. So if this was a marriage that is being arranged by the community, it was the community practice. Yeah, if they went ahead and got married on their own, and there's no ksuba. But the community would be misadir ksuba. Because it says, Ahu cheresh, there was a cheresh, Dahavei Bishiruhusei de Rav Malfiei, who lived in the neighborhood of Rav Malfiei, Ansarei Issacha, he married him off to a woman, Bekasavla, and he gave the woman a ksuba, Arba Mei Azuzei Minichsei, and the Gemara approves of this. Amar Rabba, Man Chachim, Lameba Tianosa, who would be intelligent enough to realize there is such a need, El Rav Malchiei, Gedavro Rabahu, because Kesavla Rav Malchiei says the following, Iwu Rekha Shukhula Shamshai, let's say the Cheresh wanted to buy a Shivcha to clean his house. He would have to pay for it. So if he's getting a wife, shouldn't he have to pay for it? Milos Avninim, would we not buy him a Shivcha? In other words, not be trust. We buy for him what he needs and we charge it against his property. So a Ksuba is the same thing. So, according to the Ikatarki, it's Tarki because it's both Shivcha L'Shamshay plus Aina. So the Rish is talking that even though, it's a very interesting story, even though the Iker Hadin, a Pitachas L'Cheresh, does not get a Ksuba, but Midine Apitrakis, we are authorized to incur that liability of the Ksuba, because that would be necessary for him to get a wife or whatever it is. It would be by analogy to spending money to have a shivcha l'shamsha. Now it's mashma though from the Rif, the Gemara itself, that only works if it's a cheresh who's marrying a pitachas. If it's a pikeach shenasa chereshes, we really have no reason because the pikeach is making his own decision. Meaning, we step in for the cheresh.
How do you know she was a pikachas?
Maybe she wasn't. I don't mean she had to be a pikachas, but he had to be a cheresh. Meaning this rule is when the husband is a cheresh. Because then we need to arrange a marriage on his behalf, and therefore we will impose a liability on him by analogy to the right of an apitropis to incur any expense that is necessary for the benefit of the affidavit free. Masha'in Kain, when you're talking about the woman being a chareshes, but the man is a kiteach, we would not be authorized to impose some liability on him, because he's a kiteach. We can't be an apitropis for a kiteach. And all you can impose on the man is the halachic obligation. And there is no halachic obligation of ksuba. You need her dinner, right? So therefore, this din of the rift is only talking about a man that is a cheresh, not a man that is a pikeach.
If there's no ksuba, does he get anything of hers? Does he get any of her property in marriage?
The question is, does he have, he still gets payers of Nechsev.
Why wouldn't he? I mean, there's no Kesuba. They're in exchange
for
something.
But payers are
part of the marriage.
But
they're exchanged for something.
I understand, but payers are connected with something.
Yes, the curator, yes, the liberator, she's captured, etc. It's no Kesuba.
Why
shouldn't get any?
Well, okay, you can ask your question at an earlier stage, and that is, when you say there's no ksuba,
sounds like he doesn't have to spend any money at all for anything. Why should he get anything?
Yep, yep, the Reish Shteh, Shteh Beferish in the Rambam. The Gemara doesn't say Beferish, but it's Kishem She'ein Lo Kesuva, Kach Ein Lo Mizonos, Lo Tanai Kesuva, Lo Tanai Mitanai Kesuva. So Chayra, then at that point you're right. If he has no Chiyuvim during the marriage, she would get her Maisi Yagaya and he would not get Peiros.
Right.
Because the Peiros are Mesugin Keneged Kirkuna.
Right.
He has to ransom her. And the Maisi Yagaya are Keneged Mizonos. So if there's no Mizonos, she keeps her earnings. I mean, it makes perfect sense.
Sure.
She keeps her money.
Sure.
And if there's no Kirkuna, she keeps the Peiros of her. Say, well, look, yeah, yeah. It's interesting. Is this Pashut by the Rambam says? Because the Gemara doesn't say it's a favorite.
I mean, it sounds purely Pashut. No Kesuva means no Kesuva.
Kesuva is
bilateral.
Yep, the Magid Mishnah says even your wording. That Pashut. Shetiva she'ein lo nisuin. The Torah, the Chacham, the Gino lo nisuin. Shelo b'ksuva, av tanai ksuva ima. Tanai ksuva belongs to the marital
application. So basically, the Rambam, well, I guess the Rambam goes to Shusha. Basically, the only way she's getting out of this thing is just to say, Mosala. I mean, there's no other thing she can say. She can't say, he didn't satisfy me, he didn't feed me. She has no, I mean, she can't say anything, really.
That's correct.
Well, she can't say, well, I want a divorce because you didn't feed me. You're not doing your obligation. There ain't obligations.
There's no obligations.
What's the onan? He's just one of the that doesn't have any claim of why you mean?
Yeah,
general, meta.
Yeah, that's different. I mean, the ayin is a separate.
You mean a third?
Yeah,
third disorder.
Yeah. The, but certainly she could say, he's so selfish that it's more, and that could be more. Why is more so? I just have to look well.
But no, just saying, she just said she was. But Ono is going to be Minatora and not going to be. I mean, it's not related to Ksuba in any way.
Was it sacked by the Chachamim? No, it's not sacked by the Chachamim. It's in the Torah.
Well,
so
the fact that he's not having the Ksuba
Rabbah is
the Mishnah Rabbah.
But still,
the right is there is an Indian of Ono. The right of the predated.
Some say Mizonos is the right.
No. I'm saying that it predated Yiddishkeit.
So it's
going to be an obligation.
So fundamental to the definition of marriage. Not shy after.
Well, Mizonos. How
a woman. Mizonos should make her own money.
Yeah.
In other words, if she keeps her mighty and dying, it's not such an outlaw. Let's say she's stuck to a guy without writing that.
So we're going to know that even though the Rabbanon is going to be required? If she went to bed and said, he's not Moses, there's no one over here. He's deaf, and I'm saying, he's the same, or whatever. So I'm saying, this is the best situation.
I'm confusing that.
It's not, right, it's not, you know.
I don't know, but I can't imagine that he could hold her to a marriage. Even without the Rambam in his mother, the general rule is.
But that's based on the marriage. It's not marriage, but this is marriage, and it's a weird kind of marriage because it doesn't have the fundamental aspects of marriage that we always.
Yeah, it doesn't have the economic fundamentals. There's the economic fundamentals, but this is the definition. Yeah, I don't know, I have to take an absolute mucker for this, but it seems to stubborn that you can't.
Otherwise, there's no marriage.
She doesn't have a marriage.
We're not talking about that here. This is talking about a marriage between two people. It might not have any financial obligations, but it's a marriage, right?
Yeah, it goes to the definition.
Right. They're not just living together. It's
so
true,
but not
I have to see that guy by the team of carpenters. I mean, you want to tell you that? Ayin is just another Tanakh Ksuba.
I mean, why would you? What I'm saying is, why wouldn't it? It's all part of the, you know, take care of you, with this, with this. That's a separate thing altogether. A normal marriage, without a tshuva, you would just assume it was just nothing. I mean, that's kind of weird. Marriage is not just about annoying. I don't understand what the, I'm asking. I don't know.
One thing is like our shiyuv imposed on marriage. The other is the essence of what the marriage is. I don't know if it's my favorite shemucher, but I'd have to see talk if they're shiyuvayna by cheresh, or chefereshes. Okay. We'll try to see if we find it. Okay. Now the Gemara goes weiter. If you marry a pitachas who becomes a chareshes, you can still give her a get. But if she becomes a shaita, right, so she's married to you because she was a pitachas, lo yaitzit. You cannot divorce her at all. You cannot divorce a woman that is a shaita. That's what the Mishnah says. Now the question is that a deraisa or is that a drabbanan? So the Gemara brings two days. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, the Vartaira Shaita Mishkareshes. That's Fakeris. Minataira, even if the woman is absolutely insane, you can give her a get because Gershon does not need her das. You can divorce her Bal Karcha. You can divorce a Shaita. That's what he said. We need to have a Pitachas Bal Karcha. Elamata Mamru Eid Mishkareshes. It's a Drabban indicative that you're not permitted to divorce Ishtay Shaita. Apparently, a chareshes has a certain amount of self-awareness to protect herself from abuse. A shaita, she'll walk in the street, people will just be involved with her. So the Chachamim said, you know, you cannot divorce her, you cannot turn her out in the street, people will be naive and unkept. Now the Gemara says, well, wait a second, there are different madregos here. Eichi Gami. In other words, apparently even in the shaita there are madregas. Ilema yedas lishmor gita. Now the term yedas lishmor gita.
We're saying shaita here is all about a person who becomes a shaita.
Becomes a shaita. Yeah.
If they were always a shaita and you figure this out, then it's not.
You can't marry it. If a woman was always a shaita, then you don't have it.
By default, it would go away. What is
So that would be the responsibility of the community, The problem with Europe is that the Kehillahs were so poor that they often didn't. There were like old age homes for very sick people,
But they didn't keep the crazy guy in the house. Usually the parents would.
I don't know, sometimes the parents died, the parents died, the kids were wandering the streets, the parents died young, and there's no one to take them in. I don't know, I think there's probably a study, I know at some point, towards the end of the 19th century
They would send them to places. The bigger city, they'd like take the kid and like send him on a train with some guy, and they'd take him and put him into a
crazy people.
The state would, like the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or I don't know if it's the state. They had
state sponsors. Very, very famous. Very, very famous. Institutionalizing the very dependent children, they're going to eat trade.
Oh, yeah?
And his maskana was that if halakha was a shaita, they did not feel that, right? And it just would be a force of that. That's not called the name of the Yodayim, etc. So that's an important tool. Now, again, some psychers talk about somebody who reaches the level of a shaitan. The evidence is a lot of incapacitated children are not halach to be shaitan. So it's not horrible what you say about something. Help us by shaitan, you think it's bad. It's in a place that serves children in another country. What type of shaitan will you tell me? In the Torah, I could divorce her, but in the Drabbanan, I can't. Now, anyway, Yaidash Lishmar Gita, Yaidash Lishmar Asma. Now, Yaidash Lishmar Gita is actually two ideas at once. It is a physical idea that she is able to hold on to the get and not lose it.
And she recognizes what it is.
And she recognizes that. She recognizes she's a mashal for the Emma Chazer. She recognizes she's out.
Right.
And she can also protect herself. So at that point, that's not Nava Menachemka. That you should be able to divorce, right? Me not Nava Menachemka. And if you're going to tell me she doesn't know anything, then Minachayra, you can't be Mabarisher because she's a mashal for the Chazer. You put it in her hand and we darsh it. This is really two different brushes. Meaning she appreciates what darshan is. As atzma, yatzadu, she'in la yad v'darish, as atzma. Or another drasha, it's not from the nasan v'yada, but it's mishulcha v'yada. The time in Vera Ishmael, the Shilfani Beisai, Misha Mishalta Vina Chizaras, Yasa Sazu, Shemishalta Vachizaras. So, what is Rabbi Yitzchak saying? If she is Yodas Lishmar everything, she can be divorced. And if she's not Yodas Lishmar anything, then I'm tired she can't be divorced. So, where does Rabbi Yitzchak's rule fall in that she can be divorced in a Taira? But not the Rabbanan. The answer is, Vaitzricha, Yedas Lishmar Gita. This is where you get it. She understands what a divorce is. She understands Mishalcha V'yena Chizaras. And the Melech, though, Raisa is a good get, even though she's not a Baftav, because you can be Megarish and woman Balkorcha anyway. But, even though she understands what a get is, she is not capable of protecting yourself, maybe a Das Mishma Satsman, you can show that strangers in your house or whatever it is. That is the case where the Vaitaira Miskareshas, Rayo Das Vishwara Svita, the Yom Rabbanan, Lot Iskaresh, Shema, Yidnahaguba, Minotemper. So Rabbi Yitzchak's din is very precise. It is referring only to a Shaita. Sheyodas Lishmar Gita, where it's Shayach Mino Kepter. But a true Shaitan who really doesn't understand what a get is, that Minha Taira you cannot be the Dutch. And Omar Abaya, Deipanani, and we could be Medayat from the Lashon of our Mishnah that the din of Shaitan in the Mishnah is the intermediate rabbinic category. Kami Gabi Ida Lo Yaitu. In other words, the Mishnah says, right, and I look at the lesson of the Mishnah. Cheresh nasa pikachas, pikach nasa cheresh, pikach nasa pikachas, the nischar sheresh, it says, nishtates lo yaitzi. If she becomes a shaita, lo yaitzi. Then it says, if he becomes a shaita, lo yaitzi aylamis. So the question is, given the fact that in both cases, shaita, you can't divorce, what is the nafkamina of aylamis? The answer aylamis is a more emphatic term connoting even a doraisa, but that's the deal of the vision. Agabi dida lo yaitzi, agabi dide lo yaitzi aylamis, Shemamina, ha, diyan raisa, ha, durabbanan, shemamina. Okay. So let's just see the next Mishnah. Amar Rageichen and Benuri. Now, if a woman, this is a pitachas, it was a condition via raisa, and she became a chaleshes. So there the Mishnah says you can divorce. So Yochanan Ben Uri raises the question, why if she becomes a chaleshes, not a sheita, yaitza, but if the man becomes a chalesh, ain't no lazy. What's the difference? Why does the Mishnah make such a difference? This is what Yochanan Ben Uri says. So Amruvai, so Chachamim said back to him, "Ain't no daiman or isha megaresh, isha miskaresh. You can't compare the two. Isha yaitza b'tzaynav shlovit zaynav. A woman can be divorced against her will, so you don't need her das. So look, if she doesn't understand what a get is, that's a separate kaderes hakasa. But if she understands what a get is, but she's not totally competent." You don't need her guys. So that's why if she's a chareshes, we give a get. Ha'ish ain't a mighty yellow root sign. Right? So that's part of the reason. Now, hey, it, Rabbi Yechon ben Yitzchada, right? He was made in front of the basin of Yavne. Ala chareshes she'siya avia she'yaitse v'yet. Which makes perfect sense, meaning like this. The Mishnah teaches me a pikachas who became a chareshes is yaitza beget. So what do you see from the Mishnah? That even when the kedushin is min haTorah, she could receive a get. So Yochanan ben Bigoda says the same thing would be true if she was a chareshes miikora who was married off by her father as a ketana, because it's the same principle. Right, there are two ways a chareshes can have a kedushin d'oraisa. One is pikachas sheniskarsha, and the other is a chareshes ketana that was married on ide avia. So he says the same principle of pikachas sheniskarsha will apply to a chareshes sheisura avia that is yaitza beget. And this is what we brought before: ketana bas Yisrael shenisus l'kohen. Shaychel is betrothal. And the Mela, Omru Lo, they said to him, Aksu ki yaitziba. Once you're mayed, I reversed the order apparently, he was mayed on Chareshesh and Suavia first. And then they said, Hu adin pikachas v'nisharsha. Heirish, Aksu, Shinisashi, pikachas v'nisharsha, ki yaitziba, kishayb, shacharesh, yaitziavia. Java Pisha Nisua Nisua Torah, Niskareshes, yeah, that came first. Tachzu, Hapikachas, Shenisus, Viachar Tach, Niskarsha, Afalti, Shenisua Nisua Torah, Niskareshes. Okay. Let's just read the few lines here. Amar Rava, Mieidusai, Shogar Yerkanan Ben Udada. Amar Liyazah, now what did he say? He basically said a chareshes could be miskareshes even though she's not a baridat, a basdas. So from this, we can infer the following. Amar Liyazah, if a man says to Eidei Mesira, Ra'u get zeh sha'ani nosen. Here is a get. I want to divorce my wife. V'chazar v'yomar wa kinsi shtar chayiv zeh harezu begureshes. In other words, he's afraid if he tells his wife, here's your get, she's going to scream at him, or whatever. So he basically folds up the get and says, this get is a shtar chayiv I have on somebody, could you hold this for me? Now he told the Edom, he's giving her a get, and they even read the get. So, here's the question. Is a woman divorced if she was tricked into believing that she was receiving something other than a get? Now, the Gemara does not call this. You might think, well, isn't this the problem of Mishalcha in the Chazeret, because she doesn't know if she's getting a get? Apparently that's not a problem, because she'll know in a minute. Meaning, the Shalcha doesn't have to be...
That's all you should be.
Assuming she can be. Yeah, we're talking about Pitachas here.
No.
Yeah, I understand. But then she can ask her neighbor, what is this, or something, you know. And apparently the assumption is, though, let's say she can read. The assumption is, the Shalva Lechizeres doesn't have to be at the moment of the church itself. Because at the moment she was tricked into thinking it was dark. Oh. But as long as, in the normal course, she will understand that halacha is mekoyim.
Especially if the husband passed the eggs for her.
Right. So he's tying this. Rabba's tying, this is analogous to a chareshes, who doesn't have full das. Here too, the woman doesn't have das. That's what he says. Meanwhile, Amma Rabbeinu ben Brigada, Lobahin and Daita Deisha, by a chareshes, Hachanami, Lobahin and Daita Deisha. And the Gemara Taka asks, Shita. This is a double budget for the triple woman to take it again. The answer is, it's not so budget for another reason. Mahu de Tema, Kibin the honor of Kinsi Sharkai's last, Bitule Bagla. See, I might have thought, there's another problem. I might have thought that even though he told, I mean, let's say Lamaisa, he told the Adam this again. But now, the same Adam, hear him saying, Sharkai, well, it's not a Sharkai. This could be a lush. There is a concept of a man could be mabatal get. A man could say, I hereby declare this get is bottle. Mm-hmm. So perhaps this is a backwards way of saying, I am not machshir this as a get, I mean, he was mabatal the get. So good. The issue is not that she was deceived. The issue is that maybe this is a bitola get. Yeah? And the answer is, Kamashman, we don't say that. In the east of the Baglay, the Adam Havi Amalu. If he really meant to declare that the get should be null and void, he would have said it to the same people that are still there that he had said it is a get, with the Lai Amalu who, Lai Bakle, Bahai, the Kamar Bahai. So why is he telling her, Shakai? He's embarrassed. He might start screaming at whatever.
He might do that also if he tells the Adam.
Well, she doesn't have to hear.
Not because these are actual cases, but because they're just a chakira in what a get is?
Yeah, I think, well, it could be. You know, you don't always know if the Mishnah, or if the Gemara anywhere addresses a certain case, is it simply a vehicle
right.
to understand?
So, I mean, here it seems like it's... I mean, it just sounds so strange to me. I don't understand
it
at all.
I don't know why it sounds so strange.
That somebody could be a pitachas, and then... become a chareshes.
Somehow, halakhically, it's now assumed to be a lav pardana.
We know now it's not necessarily lav pardana. It's also hard to understand because of the different. You see, a deaf person. It was hard to know the whole thing.
But that's something
born. That's what I understand as well.
But it's also like the kasha
is increased when the person actually was. Saying
halachically,
yeah, we don't have a
formality. There's no formality. I've never heard such a thing.
Well, it might be a stroke.
I understand you can lose the power of speech or something. You can't hear. I understand that. But you still know everything. You know what you knew before. Maybe we don't know.
In other words. Today, and that's another question. Today we have ways of finding out, but it could be that
at least in the time of Chazal, how that applies today is the Shaila, is that if a person did not interrogate, did not speak, did not talk, we would have no way really.
That's true.
You think that's what
the Gemara is talking about? This is Mishnah and Gemara. So you should be paralyzed.
No, that's, I'll tell you that. That's also sure, because if the Misari is only we don't know,
right?
Then Chayra Misafik.
Yeah,
we seem to say Teres Vada can't be
protected. Aren't we saying really bad? Are we saying that the Chayrish falls into this category? That's it. He is a
dumb. That's where
it's at. That's it. So once you make that jump,
he has it. Yeah,
he doesn't really have to have it. He has to fall into that category.
That's why he has it.
The problem is,
I mean,
if you're going to tell me there's Teres Akasos that say, Chayrishes can't do certain things. Goyim can't do certain things. But Chazal always talk about it in terms of Lam Pardas. Chazal don't look at it as a category. They look at it as an assumption that the person lacks a certain mental ability.
Right.
And that's difficult.
So I was wondering whether it's not a real, it doesn't really, Chayrish doesn't really mean what we might think it means. It's a whole lot of category that, they're just trying to figure out how much das do you need to get a consumer, to get a get.
But certainly, the Chayrish is real.
They didn't make them.
Well, they want to make a story. We have a case, Master Shalya.
With how common were Karashim?
What did Helen Keller
say?
That was worse than
mine. Who said?
Helen Keller.
Yeah.
Who lost the vote. That was worse than mine.
Yeah.
That's good. You can go to a new
They make the deaf and blind at different points, different ways.
Make him eat while being blind, and they make him do other things. They hold it to have him more empathetic to people in these situations.
I would say there's a Medrash Kliya. We'll look at this. They put out a statement of Medrash Kliya and emphatic brother that says the whole mice of the man. And Bnei Yisrael said, we can't stand the man anymore. So it says, we can't, you might leak in there, we shall see.
Yeah.
So what's the shaykh? Because he's saying, you see, the man can taste like whatever they want to.
Right.
And they're complaining for sick of it, that they didn't see they were eating steak. Come on, we can never stop it. Otherwise, there's a chisor and the onion shot.
Thank you.
think we both know there's no widespread panic across the country. And I think we both know, but I think we know that. And I think we also know that if it is widespread panic, it's not based in fact, and it's not based in reason. And I think more than anything, those are just words that people on TV sometimes use. But this is serious, in that two healthcare workers have died in Texas. It's very serious for their families. It's very serious in West Africa, where it is spreading, and it is an epidemic, where they don't bury people in the same way we do here, and where they don't have facilities like we do, and where one person will be the one that stays in the house with mom and dad and the grandchildren. That makes it spread, and that's awful. We don't have widespread panic in America. We should not have it. We don't have an outbreak. We have two sick people from one dying man. And the rest of this should stop, because it's not productive. And it's not worth ratings, and it's not worth politics, and we all need to stop it. Because someday there may be a real thing. Someday something may start spreading that they can't control. And then you know what we're going to have to do? We're going to have to relax and listen to leaders. You're not going to panic when we're supposed to, and we're certainly not going to panic now. We have to stop it.
You talked about conservative principles. How much longer do you think that being anti-gay rights is going to be something that's a conservative principle? And when do you think that folks like yourself who said that having a gay marriage is an attack, a bit of a hit to faith and family in America, how long do you think it'll be before you catch up with the rest of the country and realize everybody's okay?
The ones that are monopolizing the internet now can start charging individuals more. For instance, the Googles and the Amazons of the world can now charge for services that right this moment are free. And people who have money will then have access to that, and people who don't will not, right?
Well, I mean, it's...
Isn't that true, though? Well, is that a yes or a no?
It's a yes, but... We are America. I don't give a rat's
ass.
We are America.
I'm getting kind of grossed out, Judge. You blaming the government for this?
I'm blaming the government for this.
Judge,
I'm not blaming the government.
BP had more safety violations than all of the other oil companies in the country combined times 10. They cut corners in every. They cut corners everywhere. The nightmare well. The list of BP is this long, and then they stand in front of us, call us litigious, and act as if we've done something bad, that horrible man. And now you're going to turn around and blame the government for these bumbling, crazy people?
He has produced the birth certificate. It shows his mother gave birth to him in Hawaii. It is stamped and sealed by the state of Hawaii. It is confirmed, and Fox News can confirm, the President of the United States is a citizen of the United States. Period.
Climate change is real, the science is true.
Hi, yes, I'm so sorry. Just glad you were calling. I hope you're doing okay. I hope I called Israel. I asked him to come to my office after Mincha, just around 1:30, quarter to 2. I hope he will come, and if he doesn't come, I will call him again. But hopefully, we'll meet with him very shortly. Take care, and be well.
Thank you. Yeah, I didn't spoke to you.